The Women of Ill Repute, with your hosts, Wendy Mesley and Maureen Holloway.
Boobs, am I right?
Sure, but could you be a bit more specific?
Actually, it's not breasts per se. It's not the bosom, or at least not the cleavage or the side boob or even the under boob. It's not that.
Okay, I think I see where you're going here. It's the nipple.
It's the nipple.
Yeah.
That causes all the hysteria historically and today. You see all these actresses and models, the gowns that they're wearing, especially right now, we're not wearing the naked dressing, they call it. And everything is visible. Everything but
the nipple.
The nipple.
It's true.
I don't get it. Men show their nips all the time. Why are women's nipples so sexualized and therefore so threatening and therefore so powerful?
Yeah. And maybe while we're on the topic, why are bigger breasts considered better? I mean, why would bigger breasts, having a person with bigger breasts, does that mean they want to have sex more?
I don't get that. I've never understood that either. But it is a popular conception. You know, from high school, the girls with the big boobs were more likely to do it. Like, honestly, that doesn't make any sense. But if you'd like to see a lot of breasts, including nipples, or long STS, including nipples, and to maybe understand how they became symbols of social, economic, and political upheaval, you should see a documentary called Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor.
So Carol Doda, she was an American entertainer, and she was billed as the first public topless dancer in the U.S. Well, in America, which of course is the U.S. She headlined for years at the Condor nightclub in San Francisco, and she was seen as a real pioneer of a second wave. I think it's the second wave, right? Second wave feminism.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a really interesting snapshot of a time. This was the 60s. And to my mind, anyway, it seems so innocent in some ways. But in other ways, it was a lot more progressive than the climate today. I'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things we want to get into. We don't have Carol Doda anymore. She died a few years ago. But here to tell her story are the directors of the movie about her, Marlo McKenzie and Jonathan Parker. They're co-directors of Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor. Hi, guys.
Welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
Hi. We're good. Okay, right out of the gate, I got to ask you. I saw the opening credits. Lars Ulrich, the drummer from Metallica, has produced this.
Yeah, he's one of the producers, and we've been friends for about 12 years. He really liked a movie I did called Untitled back at that time, and he sought me out, and he thought I was 30 years old and living in New York, and I was actually living in Metallica's headquarters town of San Rafael, and we became friends, and he's been a big supporter ever since.
It's kind of random, but super cool.
And you live in North Beach, right? Is that why you have such a Carol Doda fixation? I want to hear from both of you about, like, why did you make this? I mean, boobs are great, but there's a bigger story here, I think.
Well, we don't live in North Beach, but we've been to North Beach. We're across the Golden Gate Bridge in Marin County, but I knew Carol from 25 years ago, when she retired from dancing. She opened up a lingerie store in a courtyard on Union Street in San Francisco, which is a shopping neighborhood. And I worked in the building, and I was a budding filmmaker at the time. And I got to know her, and we got along well. And she was famous, but I didn't really know her story. And I started researching it and really was struck by she created a career out of such a random confluence of events. She was a cocktail waitress who became she was like a go-go dancer on top of a white baby grand piano that was lowered from the ceiling in the Condor Club. And right about the same time, the Republican convention of 1964 was coming to San Francisco, and the club owners were trying to figure out how to get business into the club. And the third event that was random was that Rudy Gernreich, a famous fashion designer at the time, developed the monokini, which is a bathing suit that has two straps and does not cover the nipples that
Boom.
You're talking about.
The nipples. With the breasts, yes.
And so they bought one for her, and the rest is a very strange history.
But strictly speaking, she wasn't the first performer to perform topless, not even in the, I mean, didn't Gypsy Rose Lee or Josephine Baker, didn't they appear naked, or was she really the first?
Yeah, there were other people who had as you said, I think that they had also performed topless, but the difference here was that it became legal because of Carol. Like, it was something they called the police right away on the first night that she performed, and they said, you know, we're going to do this thing. Is that okay? And the police actually arrived and were there for her very first topless debut. And so right from the beginning, it's kind of different because her story is setting up what unrolled across the nation as something that eventually became legal. And the question of, is this obscene or not, was debated, you know, in society because of this. And ultimately they decided, yes, it's okay. You can appear topless in these certain settings. So that's kind of what distinguishes her.
Yeah, I Googled who was the first topless dancer in Canada, because we're Canadian.
Who was?
Well, it was some no-name who hid behind a guitar. So apparently there were boobs underneath the guitar. Anyway, I thought it was very, very Canadian.
Do you know who just did that? Was Kacey Musgrave. She performed on Saturday Night Live naked, but playing the guitar. So it's a time-honored tradition. But Carol Doda, this all coincided with civil rights, with the women's liberation movement. So it was kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah, it actually preceded those events, but they were all kind of percolating at the same time. The free speech movement in Berkeley was 1964, also when that started. So there definitely was, it was in the air. Cultural revolution was in the air. And Carol's part as a pioneer in the sexual revolution is a big part of it.
Well, we were trying to figure out whether she is a pioneer in a good sense or a pioneer in a bad sense, like the whole objectification. And you had, I think, Marlo, you had a bit of an issue with, because she went from a 32 to a 44. She got 44 silicone injections. So is that, Marlo, is that a good thing? Like, how do you get your head around? I mean, she said that the only way I could get into show business was to show my business, and she did.
Yeah, I mean, this is one thing I really appreciate about this documentary, the fact that we're here talking about this today, because I think that's really relevant, and this hasn't gone away. Women are still asking themselves, is this a good thing for myself, or is this not a good thing? And they're having those debates inside of themselves. And I think ultimately, Carol made the decision, you know, that this was a dream that she had. She wanted to be an entertainer. She wanted to be famous. And even though people were telling her, your body isn't enough, and that is really sad, but ultimately she made this decision for herself, and she did kind of turn it around and take a stand and say, I'm going to make my body the art, and I'm going to do this. But you're right. It is a question of, in this world, why couldn't she have been celebrated without having to inject herself with liquid silicone at the risk of her health? Why couldn't people have appreciated her body and found it beautiful and desirable as it was? Why did the pressure exist for her to change herself? These exist side by side.
It's not just, I mean, this is an issue. Cosmetic surgery is just absolutely burgeoned and exploded. And so really those issues are as much, if not as a bigger deal today, about transforming yourself to commodify yourself.
But now silicone is everywhere, it seems.
And I think, you know, she didn't just do it a little bit.
No.
She consciously took it to an extreme, and in some ways, it's almost, there's an element of satire there. There's an element of turning the male gaze sort of around in a way by doing it to such an extreme degree. I don't know. It becomes a little bit of a political statement on some level too.
Yeah, I don't disagree. We interviewed a while back just a lovely woman in every way. Andrea Wareham has written a book called Modern Whore, and she worked as a prostitute and as a stripper. I think she still does work as a stripper, Wendy. I can't remember.
Well, she's kind of famous now, and she's making a movie, so who knows?
Yeah, and she is insistent, and we don't necessarily disagree with her, but she was quite insistent that this is empowering for her, and that she's in control, and that if anybody is being taken advantage of, it's the man that she either slept with or performed in front of. And she is. She doesn't have a pimp. She worked for an escort agency. And I was thinking about her when I was watching Carol Doda. and thinking, well, she had these men that sort of like the owners, the managers. As filmmakers, did you believe that it was really that pure relationship, or did you get the sense that she was manipulated?
Well, she certainly was heavily lobbied and persuaded to do the silicone injections, but she also, to some extent, just to wear the bathing suit to begin with. That's definitely a part of it. I think there's another perspective to it from, you know, she really wanted to be in show business. She was a nightclub performer. She wanted to be on stage and singing and dancing. And she was coming from a difficult, you know, home life. She didn't have any support. She didn't have any help. And, you know, this was a time where if you looked in the help wanted section of a newspaper, it would say help wanted females. And so the jobs were secretaries and store clerks and this kind of thing. So the options were limited. She had to support herself. She started as a cocktail waitress. She started dancing everywhere she was going while she's making her cocktail runs. Clearly, you know, this is a woman who wanted to perform. But yes, was she talked into all these things by men who were owning the club and her manager? Absolutely.
Marlo, I found it really sad to read or to hear about her private life. I mean, her parents divorced when she was so young, and she ended up working very young, and she had maybe a couple of kids that she never talked about. And her whole life, it seemed, was performing, and she loved the performing, but she was also kind of a sad person. Was she not?
Well, she did have a very difficult background, but I wouldn't call her a sad person. She did end up, you know, achieving her dreams and her goals. And everyone has in their life sadness, and everyone has, you know, it's the highs and the lows. But I feel like what your question is bringing up for me is, and it kind of dovetails into what we've been talking about, is whether or not we as people, when we choose to modify our bodies for our career, are we doing this from a sense of excitement and joy and feeling good about ourselves? Yeah, we want to do this. I love myself and I totally want to like take this to the next level and make myself an artwork. Or is it something that we're doing from a place where we feel we don't have the love we need in our life? We feel a lack in our life. And I think that was a question I had about Carol. You know, she wasn't treated especially well in her past. How much were her choices influenced by the lack of love she had in her life? But I think that's what's exciting about this story, that we can kind of talk about things like this and maybe reflect back in our own lives. How are we making our choices and how are we navigating the world? And are we doing it from a place of fullness inside of us or not? So I really love these conversations that come up because of her life.
Hey there. Just so you know, Mo and I are not just the queens of podcasting.
I'm not sure we're even that, but do go on.
We're not part-time cowgirls.
We just made that up.
But we are writers. We're writers.
Wendy and I write a newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly roundup of thoughts and experiences, sometimes serious, often not.
Yeah, you're pretty funny. You write about falling down a lot. You write about your dog.
I do. You write about sex and politics and COVID.
All very, very serious things. We have a few thousand subscribers, both free and paid.
And you could be one of them if you'd like. Just go to Substack.com. and look us up by name, or go to our website at womenofillrepute.com and sign up there. We'd love to meet you there.
And now back to being the queens of podcasting.
Yeah, sure.
The Women of Ill Repute.
She was very funny. She was very composed. That's something I found throughout the documentary, that in all her interviews, she was very sure, while admitting that she was insecure, but very, very composed and very comfortable in her own skin. Some of the other people you found, I thought, were amazing. Some of the other retired performers, the women were, and as well as the academics that you found. This must have taken a lot of research, or did one person lead to the other? How did you put together this compendium of experts on toplessness?
Well, there was an aspect of one person leading to another. when Marlo kind of rediscovered this project in my drawer in my office after all these years and really wanted to get into this subject, and we decided to do it, it coincided with a book that was written by one of the original club owners, his wife, Benita Mattioli, and her book, Three Nights at the Condor. It's really kind of a biography of her husband, Pete, but it hits on these key events at the Condor Club. And so when we met them, their friends were some of these interview subjects. They knew who was still around. And, you know, one person led to another person, led to another person. And Marlo was doing a lot of social media outreach where we also found people. And when we were doing the interviews, stuff came out. You know, we'd start interviewing somebody. We thought, you know, their story was this. And then, you know, they were emboldened by the process. And, you know, we found out all kinds of other, you know, fascinating related information about them. So it was, you know, these are people who were in their 80s and even 90s in some cases. And they were just so happy that here are these people so interested in finding out what their stories were. It was really a kind of a rewarding experience to be kind of rediscovering these wonderful people, and they're wonderful storytellers.
They are. They're well-spoken and funny and rueful in some ways, but it was a real pleasure to meet these people through your film.
We were trying to figure out whether the world is more permissive or less permissive than it was in 1964, because, you know, I went to New York way after 1964 and saw, you know, the greasy guys looking through the peepholes, and that doesn't exist anymore. And it just seemed like in your film in the 60s that there may have been some objectification going on, to your point, Marlo, but it was open. It was burlesque. It was so is it more permissive now, or are we more offended now?
You know, I don't think that goes in a straight line. Not related to this subject necessarily, but I can just remember San Francisco in the late 70s. I mean, we'd go to the ballpark, we'd be smoking pot in the stands, you know, anything was like, okay. But then things changed, you know, and 10 years later, you know, whoa, boy, you can't do that, you know. So it's like it ebbs and flows about that type of thing. When the topless started, when Carol started dancing, this all had an air of innocent fun to it. And, you know, the arc of our story covering this kind of roughly 20 year period, the porn industry came in, film industry came in the 70s, things got darker, the drugs got harder, the people got harder. And, you know, you've got this rise and fall of this kind of urban scene, which really, I think, was replicated. I don't know about Canada, but it was certainly replicated in most big American cities.
I think you're absolutely right. Even the word pornography didn't seem to apply to the first half of your documentary. It seemed more of a performative time. I mean, certainly there's a sexual aspect to it, but it wasn't until the sleaze aspect came in. And I would even go so far as to say that once the internet, what did somebody say? The internet is for kittens and porn. And that it's isolated people now. You don't go out to a sex club. There was a time, I mean, before our time, but yeah, this is what it was, a time where you go to the Playboy Club. You'd go, there'd be naked women and men would have cocktails. And I'm not saying that was a good time, but now your sexual exposure is done by yourself in front of your laptop. And it seems kind of sad. Neither one is perfect. No, certainly not this one, but it does seem a lot more isolated. Anyway, that's my observation.
I think it's not related to time as well, but it's that we're more tribal now. We're in groups. So there are certain groups that are very permissive, and there are certain groups that are more conservative, and we have many, many more groups. We don't seem to have this like collective imagination that we had in the 60s. It's just people have, partly because of the internet, we have like just radically different tribes, and we all have different opinions. And whether this is good or bad, I mean, that's for individuals to judge, but that's kind of more what I'm feeling in terms of permissiveness.
I wonder too about boobs, getting back to boobs and the whole topless thing. Like, are boobs going out? Like, we've seen so many. I mean, we saw a lot in your film, some plastic and some not plastic, some big ones and some normal sized ones. Well, not that big is not normal, but are boobs out now? Well, we'll go to you first, Jonathan.
Are boobs out?
Wow, yeah, wall to wall.
Yeah. Are big boobs less important?
Just to corroborate what Wendy's saying, when they weren't readily available, I mean, I think of boys that I grew up with that would look at the catalog, the lingerie, the bras, and go, you know, use that as their pornography. Is there less interest in breasts simply because they're readily available to be seen?
I don't feel my interest in breasts has waned much. But,
even after making this movie.
But, you know, this thing about size, it's like to be under the impression that men prefer very, very large boobs, is that's not true. I mean, some men do and some men don't.
Some men do.
You know, there's no, you know, these boundaries are really pretty pretty fluid, especially in modern times. So I don't know. I don't think boobs have gone out, from what I've been able to glean from the internet.
Well, Marlo, she got 44 injections to be a 44 double D. I mean,
oh,
it's
God.
So she obviously thought, and there were a number of women in the audience, but it was mostly men who were going, wow, look at those.
But, you know, we should qualify, too, that at the time, and I thought this was really interesting, that breast augmentation basically came from the Japanese, who were using industrial silicone, and it was just injected directly into your breast. And not so much with Carol, but one of her colleagues had just a horror story about that.
Yeah, well, she tried to breastfeed, right? It was awful.
They had them injected directly into their breasts, too. They hadn't yet come into the time period where they were putting them into the silicone, into the bags. But yeah, Judy Mamou tells that story of having a, I don't know how much I should tell or should I leave it for people to watch the movie, but she had some severe repercussions from her choices to enlarge her breasts for her career. But Carol also did too. I mean, I don't know how graphic we want to get, but they harden up. And I mean, she was 5 feet two, and she had these very large breasts that had hardened. That's a severe, that's very difficult to deal with, I think, for your entire life. So that is a sad part, that her choice, it was just something she had to deal with.
Just to add to that, and I did appreciate the mention that, you know, people don't want to see old boobs. And that's true today as well as any time. And so it really puts a limit on your career, no matter whether they're big or small. It's just, you had to, well, she was 40, I think, when she stopped performing, which actually was pretty long in the tooth for that profession.
Yeah, she was probably about mid-40s, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
So what's indecent exposure now? Because, you know, I just wrote a rather silly piece about the guy in Salters dancing around half naked, and we're seeing male nudity. So are we shocked by anything anymore, or are we too shocked? I don't know.
Nudity still seems to be quite provocative, and having made this film, it's kind of shocking that it is. I mean, you're asking about, like, are breasts out?
Going out of style.
You know, it's like some things never get old. I think the proliferation of women, and I suppose men as well, on the internet, who are, you know, trying on clothes in dressing rooms and, you know, exposing their bodies, seems to be, you know, a whole, like, almost cottage industry on its own.
That's funny. We haven't lost our childlike sense of wonder when it comes to seeing people bare naked. And I guess that's a good thing.
Was there stuff that you couldn't put in the movie? Because I guess I'm trying to figure out, there was her story, and there were people who wanted to talk about it. But it also gets into sort of the, should you have injections? Should you do silicone? Here's what happened, blah, blah, blah. So were there big debates in your household that you had to figure out how to place it in the movie or not?
I mean, we definitely talked about how long to linger on shots, when to cut short. If we include a shot of a needle, is that too much? And one of the moments that did come up was someone who we interviewed was saying that Carol was getting her breasts enlarged, and at some point she was just right. And we happened to, in a rough cut of our edit, have an image of Carol when she was just right. And so then the team had a talk about that, because there is no just right.
Right, exactly.
Everything is just right. And how did that image get there? We weren't really thinking. And so we took that image out, and I think we just put something that had nothing to do with a filmmaker judging just right. So we had conversations that were really important like that. That's just one of them.
Yeah, and I can remember in one of the archival shots of there was, you know, three during the full nude period, you know, the cameraman was just like zeroing right in on, a woman's crotch. And it was just like, oh, my God, we can't like put this in the movie. This is ridiculous. So, yeah.
That's right. I wanted to mention that. That was a really surprising tidbit, that you could perform naked, but you had to wear a G-string with a little merkin, like a little pubic wig, which is the most ridiculous thing ever. It's for down there. Yeah.
It's like a baby, only it's for down there.
Yeah, I know. I know. People are funny, aren't they?
Put your merkin over your...
Some of those had to be trimmed too. I remember like Art Tanish telling the story about having to just do the tailor was too embarrassed. He had to do it himself. He's get in there and trim it.
You've made a lovely movie. Yeah. A lovely film. It's she's quite a character, but what I loved about it was just capturing a time. So a time and a place. So evocatively, it was a real joy to watch.
Yeah. The footage was amazing. Just seeing what it was like back in the 60s. I mean, we were babies maybe, but it was pretty amazing to see the footage. So well done.
Yes. Thank you. Carol Doda, Topless at the Condors. Great title, isn't it? It does get your attention. And it is opening wide, as they say, or opening in major cities. And I think it's going to stream. Do you have the particulars?
Yeah. It opens on March 29th in select theaters in Canada. And then it expands to more cities there on April 5th.
Okay. Well, congratulations. And thank you for spending time with us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye. So, Maureen, is it bad that I said the boobs are out? Because they're never going to be out.
I like Jonathan's response. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I've never lost. It kind of reminds me of, you know, gynecologists. Do they go? I mean, that's the perpetual question. Do you lose interest when it's work, work, work? But apparently not.
I know what the appropriate answer is.
What? No, the answer is no, never. So I have never been to a strip show or a sex club or anything like that, except once. I know it's not that I eschew it. I just never went.
Well, I was, but it was always work related. So tell me about your episode. Okay, God.
So I was in San Francisco and I was on Broadway, exact same place. And it was the 80s. And I was with my boyfriend at the time, as opposed to the boyfriend I have now. And he said, let's go to a sex. And they weren't burlesque. It was, let's go to a sex show. And I'm like, ah. And we headed down Broadway, and it was more of the sleazy type where people are out. What do you call them? Barkers or whatever. They're trying to get you into the club and
bringing people in, yeah. Saying that there's naked ladies inside.
Yeah, there's naked whatever. Ladies. Yeah. So come on in, come on, come in, come on in. So and you pick one at random. And so this guy or girl, I can't remember, took us into this club and pulled back a curtain, and it's pitch black. And they lead us all the way down in the dark to the front of the stage where somebody was on stage performing. And I was extremely self-conscious, like anybody could care that I was there. But we're sitting there and the guy comes to take our order, and it's a 2-drink minimum. So we have to order 4 drinks. And my boyfriend said, well, how much are they? And he said that it's $30 a drink. And you got to realize this is in the 80s. So that was $120. And he said, we're out of here, because he was a cheap mofo.
So he wasn't into the booze.
No, he didn't. Well, he was. He just didn't want to pay $120 bucks American for four juice glasses full of beer. And so he'd grab my hand and we left and they made it as difficult as possible to leave the club. But that was my exciting time in a sex club in San Francisco. For all I know, it could have been Carol Doda.
Well, it could have been. Oh, no. It could have been. So she died in 2015. And it was kind of sad at the end, but she kept performing until the end, which is kind of cool. Yeah.
Well, she sang, too. She stopped stripping and she started singing. She wasn't a bad performer, but she went out with Frank Sinatra as well. I forgot to ask about that.
I know. Yeah. Well, apparently, according to the movie, she had the hots for Frank Sinatra. And she would sneak out the back. And there was a special staircase that was built for mobsters or girlfriends.
Oh, Frank. It was a similar time.
Say whatever you want. Yeah, it was another time. But yeah.
Carol Doda, topless at the Condor, and it's opening wide, as they say, and it probably come to a streamer. It's really interesting to see, especially if you like boobs of all sizes all day long.
Women of Ill Repute was written and produced by Maureen Holloway and Wendy Mesley, with the help from the team at the Sound Off Media Company and producer Yet Belgraver.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Nickel, four-time Winter Olympian and host of Dropping In, a podcast with Mercedes. This is a podcast where I interview a bunch of different people. I get the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as I share my stories along the way. Now you can drop in at droppingin.com or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. I'll see you soon.